May it please the court. My name is Scott Harrison. I'm an attorney representing the plaintiffs in this action, Farah Gary, Inc., and Farah Jarrett Farms, and their action is in U.S. St. Nazianz. As the court is aware, this is a products liability action. On appeal from the grand summary judgment by the District Court of Eastern District of North Carolina. And Your Honor, I believe it's a very straightforward case that where the District Court overlooked some key facts and omissions by Miller's representatives and witnesses, that there was a defect in the salvage bags and sold to our clients, and therefore we should have been admitted to proceed in our claims of negligence, breach of express warranty, breach of implied warranty. As a quick background, this case involves salvage bags. Court is familiar with salvage bags. These are bags that are, these are plastic bags that are sold to farmers. Their farmers store their feed for the coming year after they harvest their crops. They're expensive bags that are made of plastic. They are about 10 feet in height, about 250 to 300 feet in length. And they store tons of salvage bags, store tons of the crops for the coming year. In this case, my client purchased 26 bags from Miller, three Miller's representatives, and eight of those bags failed, resulting in substantial damages to the client. That damage is about $171,000 because of an admitted defect in these bags. And because of these defects, he did have to go out of business. He had to shut down his farm. He'd been a farmer about 30 years.
Speak up a little more clearly so we can hear what you're saying.
Yes, ma'am. The first issue I want to bring to the court's attention is that we provided ample evidence of direct evidence of a defect in these bags that should have permitted us to proceed in our claim of negligence against Miller.
Did you have an expert that did any testing on the bags? Or did you have an expert testimony going to the defects?
Your Honor, we had an expert who looked at the bags and opined as the possible causes for the defect.
But he didn't do any testing, and he said...
No, Your Honor.
That basically, as I read the record, you used the inference that because the bags failed, there was a defect.
For some parts, Your Honor, but for negligence, we had an admission by Miller's representatives that these bags were defective when they were sold to our client. Mr. Pessing.
I don't know that that's quite correct in the test. This was a representative of the defendant.
Yes, Your Honor. In the deposition of Mr. Pessing, who was the 30B6 witness of Miller, he testified that the bags were defective. I believe it was on page 1870 of the judicial appendix. And we think that they are, in order to prove a negligence claim, a product liability claim grounded in negligence, the plaintiff must prove, one, that the product was defective at the time it left control of the defendant, two, the defect was the result of the defendant's negligence, and three, that the defect proximately caused the plaintiff damage. In this case, we relied upon the statements by Mr. Pessing, who confirmed that there was a defect in these bags, as well as the statements from Mr. Art Schutte, who was Miller's territory manager, an expert witness, who also testified that these bags were defective, these eight bags were defective. I believe his testimony regarding that is on page 1076 of the judicial appendix.
Well, let me talk about that testimony at Joint Appendix at 1869 and 1870. Where I think you kind of mischaracterized Mr. Pessing's testimony. He wasn't qualified to offer an expert opinion. You agree with that?
I agree with that.
All right. And he testified that the defendant treated plaintiff's warranty claims as viable losses under the limited warranty that covered defects in the material and workmanship and provided replacement bags under that warranty.
Yes, sir, but I think we then asked the next question.
What I'm getting at is, as I understand it, his testimony went only to the warranty claims.
But then I think the next question did ask whether or not they felt that the bags were defective, and he answered over the defense objection, he did say yes.
Well, he did testify that the bags were tested by the defendant and determined to be defective.
Correct. You're correct, Your Honor. But they still did admit that they were defective. I don't know how they arrived at that opinion. They did testify they were defective, and that should have provided us an inference that there was negligence on the part of Miller. And that would go on to the second. So, in order, all we need to prove is that the product was defective at the time it left control of the defendant. The second part is that the defect was the result of the defendant's negligence. Now, Your Honor, based upon the testimony of Mr. Pesek, we believe that, and Mr. Schutte, that an inference of manufacturer's negligence arises upon proof of an actual defect in the product. And in this case, Miller, while they're not the actual manufacturer of these bags, they were the apparent manufacturer, and they had a duty to, under the Red Deer Hosiery Mill case, they had a duty to use reasonable care throughout the manufacturing process, including making sure that the product is free of any potentially dangerous defect in manufacturing or design. This duty of care may involve inspection or testing of the product, which includes the duty to inspect the products manufactured by another, which are component parts of the product produced by the manufacturer. In this case, I think it's pretty clear that Miller did not test these bags prior to selling them to our plaintiff. In this case, they had been a long-standing agricultural machinery manufacturer. In 2004, they decided to get into the silage bag business, and they bought the assets of a company called Ag Bag International. At that time, this company, Ag Bag, had been in agreement with a company called Up North Plastics to manufacture these bags. But when Miller acquired Ag Bag International, they decided to enter into another agreement with a company called High Class NV. High Class NV is a company based in Belgium. And of course, at the time, Miller did not have a copy of the formula to manufacture these bags. Therefore, they asked High Class to reverse engineer one of the Up North bags and then produce that and manufacture those bags to sell to the public. But they never, once they asked them to test it or reverse engineer it, they then never did any inspections or any testings on the product. They had then sold it. Now, while they weren't the actual manufacturer, there are two reasons why they should have been held accountable for selling these defective bags. The first, for not testing the product. The first is that Miller likely relied upon the sealed container defense. That's North Carolina General Statutes 99B-2A, which provides that no action shall be commenced or maintained against a seller when the product was acquired and sold by the seller in a sealed container. This is known as the sealed container defense. However, in this case, there's an exception. The provisions of the sealed container defense do not apply if the manufacturer of the product is not subject to the jurisdiction of the courts of North Carolina. And in this case, Miller filed a third-party complaint against High Plast. However, it was dismissed in subject matter jurisdiction because Miller did not have, or High Plast did not have any ties to North Carolina. Therefore, the sealed container defense should not apply in this case. And they should be held accountable for selling these products without testing them. In addition, the case I had the court this morning is the Wierzynski versus Empire Comfort Systems Incorporated. In this case, the North Carolina Court of Appeals in 1991 adopted the second restatement of torts.
I don't want to cut you off, but that was a 1991 case, was it not?
Yes, sir.
Which was in existence at the time you filed your brief.
Yes, sir.
That was not brought up before the district court.
Actually, it was in the district court's, it was in the materials we provided to the district court.
It was in
my brief provided to the district court.
Was it argued before the district court?
It was the district court granted summary judgment without argument.
We don't take up a matter that was not presented in the first instance before the district court.
It was in the briefs.
Did the district court comment on that in its summary judgment?
They did not, Your Honor.
Was there no evidence that the district court really considered?
No, Your Honor. But we did address the 99B-2. In addition, Your Honor, in addition to the fact they sold these products, let me go to the next point. In addition to some, the fact they sold these products without testing them, they began receiving reports in June and July of 2005. There was a major bag problem with the bags that they were selling to various dealers, various farmers across the country. The New York Territory Manager reported that we have run into a major bag problem in July of 2005. The Territory Manager in Indiana, Ohio, and Illinois reported that far too many bags were going down at this time. Yet, Miller continued selling these bags to my clients in August of 2005 without doing any kind of testing or any kind of inspection on these products. Therefore, we believe, and then in November of 2005, Miller did eventually follow up a notice of recall on these defective bags. However, this was after my client had already experienced 8 bags breaking. Therefore, because Miller admitted there was a defect in these bags, because they didn't do any actual testing on the bags when they were receiving reports, we held that, or we believe that we should have established a claim of negligence against the defendant. My next point that was argued before the district court is that the district court incorrectly held that my client chose the remedy of the warranty of receiving 2 replacement bags rather than seeking consequential damages. In this instance, Mr. Archschutte, the territory manager, filed the warranty claims. He then brought the bags to my client. My client never actually assented to the terms of the warranty, never actually chose to remedy his problems that way. He did receive the bags, but there was no meeting of the minds that he had actually assented to the terms of the warranty.
What else do you contend should have been done?
They should have asked if he wanted to file a warranty claim at the time, and it says this.
You think a manufacturer is going to come up with someone where there's a problem with the product and say, hey, do you want to choose another remedy?
That's what we would like for them to have done that. Because this time, again, our client was trying to save his farm and make sure that he kept all his crops. He wasn't thinking about a lawsuit at the time. But the second point that the district court overlooked is that both Mr. Pesek and Mr. Schutte admitted that the bags that they were provided, at least one of the bags that were provided to Mr. Farah under the replacement program were also bad bags. Therefore, we contend that the warranty failed its essential purpose, because why would a farmer choose to receive additional bad bags, and how does that satisfy the warranty program by providing additional defective product?
On the other hand, if the consumer believes the product he got was defective, why would he agree to take more of the same product?
Exactly right. That's, we don't think that he ever agreed to fully to take these products. They were provided to him by Mr.
Schutte. He took them and used them.
He used some, yes, Your Honor. He was, again, trying to protect his crops and protect his livestock. The next point was our breach of implied warranty merchantability claim. And we believe that this claim can be proven through circumstantial evidence. And there are several factors that are laid out by the North Carolina Supreme Court in DeWitt versus Ever-Ready Battery. This is a 2002 North Carolina Supreme Court case. And it holds that a plaintiff may produce adequate circumstantial evidence of a defect, and they list 6 factors. The 6 factors are, 1, the malfunction of the product, 2, expert testimonies to a possible cause or causes, how soon the malfunction occurred after the plaintiff
first. Do you have that expert testimony?
Excuse me?
Do you have that expert testimony?
He opined as the possible causes. He looked at the.
Did you have an expert who did any testing on the bags?
No, Your Honor.
Then where is your expert testimony?
He merely looked at the bags that were provided by Up North, and the bags that provided a high-class stance said that the extrusion streaking they saw in the high-class manufactured bags would possibly lead to the breakage.
Possibly.
Yes, sir.
But he acknowledged that he did not do any testing, any expert testing on the bags, and he didn't render any expert opinion.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah, thank you.
And then the next point is how soon the malfunction occurred after the plaintiff first obtained the product. The 4th is similar incidents. The 5th is elimination of other possible causes of the accident. And 6th, proof tending to establish that such an accident did not occur. And let me just go through the first one, is that the product did not function. The second, we addressed the expert testimony. The malfunction occurred soon after our client began using these bags, in that summer of August and April of 05 after he purchased them. There were numerous similar instances outside of the record where other farmers had the exact same problem, and this necessitated a recall by Miller in November, December of 05. Elimination of other possible causes. Mr. Schutte and Mr. Hessick both agreed that the problems with these bags were not due to my plaintiff, to the plaintiff in this action.
But did your expert say there are other possible causes?
Yes, Your Honor. There are other possible causes, but I don't believe that. I think that we ruled those out in this case based on the testimony of Mr. Schutte and Mr. Hessick, who were expert, or Mr. Hessick, Mr. Schutte, who's the territory manager. He was on the farm frequently during this time period. He confirmed that the problems were not caused by my plaintiffs.
Are you talking about this PowerPoint presentation that was made by the defendant?
It's made by High Class, Your Honor.
Well, isn't that hearsay?
It was provided by High Class to the defendants in a meeting in Belgium in November 2007.
I understand that High Class is not a defendant in this case.
Correct, Your Honor. But
in that report, that PowerPoint presentation, which is Joint Appendix 1301, isn't that hearsay?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe there's an exception though, to that, because it's a present sense impression that Mr. Hessick and Mr. Schutte both witnessed that PowerPoint presentation. They can testify to what they observed. I think that Mr. Pesic testified on page 1875 of this deposition, or of the judicial appendix, 1879, that High Class admitted that they had a problem with the 10-foot size bags.
Isn't that hearsay?
I believe that's a present sense impression of what he observed. Yes, it is, but it's an exception. Thank you, Your Honor.
That's a good time.
Time's up.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. Our next attorney is Ross Anderson. Everybody relax. Not Judge Ross Anderson. All right, Mr. Anderson, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. And yes, I was asked as soon as I came through the metal detector this morning if I was related to Ross Anderson. And I said, other than being him, no. So. May it please the court, it is truly a privilege to be here in front of the Fourth Circuit today, and it's always a privilege for a Seventh Circuit lawyer to come south in this time of year. Anyway, I represent the defendant in this case, Miller St. Nazians, which is a small family-owned farm implement manufacturer located in St. Nazians, Wisconsin, which is just outside of Green Bay. It's important, after hearing the questions that were asked, and I'll get to those questions in just a minute, it's important for me to point out what Miller was and what Miller was not in connection with these silage bags. Miller's been manufacturing farm implements and machinery since the 1940s. They have not had any kind of plastic line. They were not involved in the plastic business until November 30th of 2004, when they acquired the assets of a company called AgBag, which was located in Iowa. AgBag manufactured bagging machines, which Miller still produces. And the bagging machines take the silage and put it into silage bags, which are then stored in the field at the farm. Miller did not manufacture or never attempted to manufacture the silage bags because Up North had an exclusive contract, or because AgBag had an exclusive contract with Up North. Miller decided to switch manufacturers of the bags, and they switched to High Class in Belgium. High Class designed or came up with the formula to manufacture the bags and manufactured them for Miller under the AgBag name. That relationship lasted from the beginning of November of 2004 through January of 2006, at which point in time Miller divested itself of the bag business, and AgBag now has licensed the AgBag name back to Up North, and they are manufacturing the bags. Miller doesn't have anything to do with the relationship any longer. During that time period, which was a year and 2 months, Miller sold 22,000 bags through its independent dealers.
Mr. Harris mentioned several times that his client purchased the bags from Miller. He didn't. He purchased them from an independent contractor who was a Miller representative. He purchased two sets of bags, one in August, April of 2005, from a dealer in Maryland, and then in August of 2005 from a dealer in Florida. And those are the two purchases of bags, and it is out of those 26 bags that he purchased that the eight bags that are the issue of this lawsuit come. He had purchased 20 bags the year before and also filled his silage that year, and he in fact still had some of those bags left over that he was still feeding cattle out of as well. He did not have any problems with bags in 2004, only with the 2005 purchases that he made. So with that, I want to get to some of the issues that Mr. Harris raised and some of the questions that the court had of him. From their standpoint, they argue that the district court overlooked key facts in the case. We obviously disagree vehemently with that. The district court paid very, very careful attention to the record, which is voluminous, in issuing its decision. This case was very well developed from a factual standpoint. We had gone through all of the, it initially was commenced as a class action. We went through all of the certification discovery, had the certification motion, and the class action was denied by Judge Devers, and that was not appealed. We then became just a single product liability action with Mr. Farrar's claims, and all of that discovery took place, experts were named, and we reached the close of discovery, and somewhere right around the timing of the close of discovery was the time for filing dispositive motions, which was what led to our summary judgment motion. So the trial court, in essence, had the full factual, fully developed factual record of this case before it when he made his decisions. And the first issue I want to direct, or I want to address, is the direct evidence of defect issue. As the court knows, one of the basis of Judge Devers' decision to dismiss or grant summary judgment on the negligence claim was that Mr. Farrar was trying to stack an inference on an inference. They were inferring that there was a defect in the bags because they did not have an expert witness to establish a defect in the bags. They were also inferring that Miller was negligent because there had been a malfunction in the bags.
Well, their position, as you know, is that there was a concession by your 36 witnesses that the bags were defective and that constituted direct evidence. And so they were not in the position of piling evidence on top of that. So I need to hear from you on that.
Yes, sir. And that's where it's very important to do just what Justice Hamilton did and take a look at the actual testimony. The two witnesses, Steve Pesek, who was our 36 witness, was the individual at Miller who was in charge of marketing. He's not a plastics expert, he's not a bag expert. He's our marketing person, and recalls and warranty claims fall under his area of practice at Miller. The second individual who was named was Art Shuey, who is a ag bag machine expert in that he's a farmer, he's been selling ag bag machines for 30 years. He understands how the bags work, he understands how the bags are to be packed. He was our district sales representative for North and South Carolina and Southeast United States. Both of those individuals testified that, well, Mr. Shuey first was called to the farm when the problem occurred. He thought the bags had been overpacked and failed because they had been overpacked, but he wasn't sure, so he gave Mr. Farrar the benefit of the doubt and submitted the warranty claims. Mr. Pesek up in Wisconsin processed the warranty claims because the district field superintendent had sent them in and said, this is a warrantable claim, and under our warranty, which warrants that the bags will be free from defects in materials or workmanship, we should give him the two bags. So the claim was processed. Mr. Pesek said, I treated it as a defect because the warranty claim came in. We did not challenge it with Mr. Farrar from that standpoint. But to rise to the level of a defect on a negligence claim, you would need to have someone with plastics expertise who can testify that there was a specific defect in this bag.
Do you have any case law to support that position, that an admission on behalf of the company has to come from an expert? mean, this is your 30B6 witness. This is the person you've designated to speak on behalf of the company. And if they make an admission, are you saying it doesn't count unless they're an expert?
This is the person that we designated to speak on behalf of the company with respect to the warranty claims, and that's where the deposition was going, and that's what Mr. Pesek testified to. Miller never tested these bags. If there was testing done, it should have been done.
Well, my question goes, is who can make a concession and admission on behalf of the company?
I believe someone who is qualified to make that concession as to whether or not the bag is actually defective. He can certainly say that we treated it as defective and paid the farmer the warranty claim, which is exactly what he testified to.
Well, isn't that some kind of inference there that is useful in sorting this out?
It may be an inference. It's not direct evidence of a defect in the bag because he's not qualified to give that testimony. But the issue that Judge Devers had with the plaintiff's claim was that they were using an inference to prove defect, and they were using an inference to prove negligence on the part of Miller. And the Red Hill Hosiery case in North Carolina says that you can't put an inference on top of an inference. You need to have the direct evidence, and in negligence claims, that virtually always comes from an expert who is qualified to give that testimony.
Well, if it is a legitimate admission that the company is bound by, does that constitute direct evidence?
I don't believe it constitutes direct evidence. It may be something that binds the company, but direct evidence would be direct evidence of a defect in the bag. And that's something that...
An admission is not direct evidence. Is that what you're arguing?
Well, but I don't mean to argue with you, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
No, I understand. We all understand what that word means.
The direct evidence was that we treated it as defective for purposes of the warranty claim. And therefore, we paid out under our warranty. And Judge Devers never even addressed the question of the DeWitt factors that are used in North Carolina to prove defect under warranty, because Miller had made that concession in terms of its dealings with Mr. Farrar.
Is there a difference in defective, well, not bags defective, depending on whether the plaintiff's theory is negligence or the theory is...
Well, there certainly was under the DeWitt case that the North Carolina Supreme Court addressed, because that's where it used those factors that you can bring in inferences to prove the defect, and it said that for purposes of a warranty claim, the sin is oftentimes the failure of the bag, not what the specific cause of the failure was in terms of whether it was defective. I just said the bag, the failure of the product, and not specifically what caused the product to fail. And from a manufacturing standpoint, there are a number of factors that enter into that decision. You have a good client, you want to keep the client happy, you want to stand up, you want to stand behind it and live with your product. So you may well make a determination to, as Mr. Schutte testified in this case, you may well make a determination to give the customer the benefit of the doubt and say, okay, we'll treat this as a product defect and we will replace it with the two bags as our warranty requires us to do. And that's exactly what happened here.
Well, as you know, ideally, manufacturer's representative will say, without admitting any liability or
yes, sir,
or admitting it's defective, we will give you the benefit of the doubt and we will replace it. The appellant contends that's not what happened here, that it wasn't an admission.
Well, and certainly if you read Mr. Schutte's testimony and Mr. Pesek's testimony, which was related to the treatment under warranty, and Mr. Schutte's testimony, where that he couldn't absolutely say for certain that he felt he thought the cause of the problem was that the bags had been overpacked, but he could not say it for certain, so he gave Mr. Farrar the benefit of the doubt.
You
mentioned
a question.
The second aspect that I wanted to address was the inference of negligence that the appellant is making against Miller. As Justice Hamilton pointed out, they did not have an expert in this case who identified any defect in the bags which had been manufactured in Belgium. Miller did not test the bags. Miller was not involved in the testing. He says that we rely on North Carolina Statute 99B-2A, which is the sealed container defense, and that's the case that he gave to the court and to me this morning that discusses that. And I believe that's erroneous in this case. The sealed container defense under 99B-2A allows a seller of a product who sells a product in a sealed container to raise that as an affirmative defense, and the seller cannot be sued under those circumstances. Miller has never raised that as an affirmative defense here. 99B-2A, well, it also only applies if the manufacturer is not subject to the jurisdiction of the North Carolina courts. In our case, Miller had cross-claimed against Hyplas, and we lost the jurisdiction motion on Miller's claims against Hyplas, which were based on a contract signed in St. Mazian's, Wisconsin. The plaintiff voluntarily dismissed its claims against Hyplas shortly before the jurisdiction hearing. So Judge Deaver never ruled whether or not the plaintiff's claims had jurisdiction over Hyplas for the injuries which occurred here in North Carolina with the high, which occurred in North Carolina with the Hyplas bags. But be that as it may, Miller has not raised 99B2A as a defense in saying that you can't sue us because we sold the bags in a sealed package. Rather, what Judge Deaver's pointed out is that Miller, as a supplier, has a very different duty than the manufacturer of the bags had. And in this case, the plaintiffs did not have an expert witness to testify as to what Miller's duty as a supplier was and whether or not that duty was breached. Miller sold over 22,000 bags during the year and several months that it was doing this, and they had 191 warranty claims. That's less than 1% of warranty claims out of all of the bags that were sold, and approximately 109 of those warranty claims were recognized by Miller as being warranty claims. The others were a problem with the bag, but were caused by the farmer and were not honored by Miller as a warranty claim. There's no evidence in the record as to whether or not Miller had some duty to inspect, some duty to react differently, whether this was a failure rate that was at all abnormal in the industry, or whether this should have alerted a reasonable supplier to any kind of problem that they had to do any sort of inspection for latent defects of the silage bags that were being sold and manufactured by Hyplas. So from that standpoint, far from having an inference of negligence on Miller, there isn't any evidence of negligence on Miller's part. The other two items that Mr. Harris talked about related to the warranty claims, and I'm going to switch over to those claims from negligence unless there are some more questions about the negligence claims. I'll briefly address the warranty claims. The warranty claims are pretty straightforward. Miller's warranty, which was contained both in the manual and with the instructions that were on the bags, limited the remedies that were available to Mr. Farrar under the warranty. If a bag was considered, was treated by Miller and the warranty was honored, he was to be given one bag to replace the bag that had a problem. If he had to rebag the silage, he was given two bags. These bags are not inexpensive. They run somewhere between $400 and $600, depending on the size of the bag. And they weigh several hundred pounds, as you might imagine, they're quite large. So it was not by any means an insignificant warranty. Mr. Farrar gladly took advantage of that. He accepted all of the replacement bags from Miller for each of the silage bags that failed. And the evidence in the record is clear from Mr. Schutte and Mr. Pesek that Mr. Farrar was provided with replacement bags for the bags that failed. He was also provided with bunker covers to provide some additional cover for his feed, and was provided with a great deal of physical assistance by Mr. Schutte, who assisted him in the rebagging process on several occasions. So there's no argument here along the lines of the North Carolina cases where they discuss a manufacturer's inability to repair a defect or otherwise fulfill a warranty. In this particular instance, Miller did fulfill the warranty with replacement bags whenever there was a problem with the bag, and in addition provided other assistance. Sorry, I thought I cut some off. The unconscionability argument is laid out in the briefs. As the court knows, in a commercial context, there's no presumption of unconscionability of a consequential damage exclusion in a warranty. Mr. Farah obviously does not like the damage limitation, but Judge Devers very clearly held that Mr. Farah was a sophisticated dairy farmer. He accepted the warranty, accepted the replacement bags, and therefore under 2-317, I'm sorry, 327, he voluntarily assumed that as his remedy and decided to elect that remedy rather than going under other remedies that were available to him under the code. With that, if there's no additional questions.
Good. Thank you, Anderson.
Thank you.
Harris, you have some time to reply.
Yes, Your Honor, please the court. Very brief. I just wanted to address three things very quickly. Again, we believe that statement by Mr. Pesek, who's a corporate officer, was a binding admission, at least a disputed issue of fact as to whether or not there's a defect in these bags. Therefore, we should at least be permitted to present our case to a jury based on that admission. We don't know how they arrived at that determination, whether they did testing on their own or they relied upon statements by high class or any taste testing by high class. We believe that he confirmed there was a defect in the bag. If there's any case law stating that an expert witness, that we need to hire an expert witness to determine the exact defect, the exact proprietary composition of these bags, when Miller's 30B6 witness concedes there was a defect, as well as Mr. Pesek, who was also one of their employees. The next point I want to address is the fact that Mr. Roth, Mr. Anderson brought up is the fact that Miller is merely a supplier. We dispute that. We think that Miller is not just a supplier or a mere conduit. They were actually, they actually should be held accountable as a manufacturer because at all times the bag stated Miller's ag bag, the warranty and advertising documents all referred to Miller's ag bag, the instructions for use, also this is how to use Miller's ag bag. Therefore, no reasonable purchaser would have known they were actually manufactured by another company, not Lex in this case. And this would be, if I can, the court will indulge a colloquialism. This would be like if someone goes to Best Buy to buy a Sony TV, they know that they're buying a Sony TV, a TV manufactured by Sony at Best Buy. However, they buy a TV at Best Buy that says it's branded Best Buy, but they don't know who actually manufactured it. They assume that Best Buy is the manufacturer, when in reality, Samsung or Sharp or Sony may have been the actual manufacturer. But Best Buy should be held accountable, just like Miller in this case. And then the last thing is, again, we believe that Miller conceded that they did supply our client with admittedly bad bags as part of the replacement program. And therefore, it failed its essential purpose, and we should be able to seek our consequential damages. Therefore, in wrapping up, I just respectfully request that this court reverse the district court's grant summary judgment. And thank you. It's been an honor and pleasure.